what is health span? So if we imagine it as a curve, right? Health span is like the years that are free from disease, right? So it could be cancer, it could be heart attack, stroke, it could be Alzheimer's, dementia, or metabolic syndrome like diabetes. Right? I'm Kenneth, I'm the co-founder, CEO of Mito Health, and we've been around for about a year now, and we exist very much in the longevity tech space. The size of the challenge is 8 billion people, right? In one line, insurance is the best investment that pays you the most when you need it the most. You get cancer, that's a payout. If you get heart attack, that's a payout. If you get into a car accident and you're in the hospital, there's also a payout, or they even pay for your bed. Vipassana meditation is a silent retreat. So it's a 10-day silent retreat. It can be done everywhere around the world, and you spend 10 days essentially just meditating and not talking to anyone. My wife did it, changed her life. Then my mom did it, changed her life as well.
Did it change your life?
Did it. Yeah, so I'm Kenneth. I'm the co-founder, CEO of Mito Health. And we've been around for about a year now. And we exist very much in the longevity tech space, which is a very new field that is up and coming in this part of the world.
So before we dive into that, you also built a finance community called Seedly.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to understand your upbringings. Can you describe what your childhood was like?
Yeah, so I grew up with a brother, an elder brother, and then wasn't a very bright student for a while, but was very naturally inclined to the sciences. So I always knew that I was going to do something in science. But back then when we were growing up, tech wasn't a thing, right? So, I mean, there was like Game Boys, there were Nokia phones, but I was never really good at like programming or Dreamweaver, right? Website building. So I was always exploring the idea of tech. And during my university days, I really got into it. So I realized that tech, and back then, mobile phones were really becoming a thing. So iOS, app development, Android development. And then I realized that actually there's a lot of business to be done in terms of bringing business and tech, the two worlds together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I dive deep into that. My father was an entrepreneur, so he was doing paper trading for his whole life. Very traditional business, and you saw how money flowed. So it's interesting because
Can you explain what paper trading is?
Yeah,
for the audience.
So basically, he would import and sell paper. There's a bit of import-export element without actually holding the stock. So it's the first version of drop shipping, if you will. So the idea there is you buy huge reams of paper. So really like huge containers and pallets of paper from Europe. You would sell them to Indonesia. You would go to Indonesia. You would process the paper. You would sell it to somewhere in Southeast Asia. So you would always be the connector. Back then, internet wasn't a thing. So you would fax, you would call, you would email. Early days of email. And then there was a business for that. But when things were disintermediated, like with Alibaba, with online exchanges for paper, even there's exchanges for paper as well, then the role of the middleman became less and less important.
So what did he do at that moment?
So he was slowly winding it down. And then suddenly he got into a very bad accident. When he was 50 years old, he was cycling. He got hit by a taxi, did a full body MRI, found that he had brain cancer, which is also something crazy because I was going through that tough period while building my first startup in year two, I think, of building Seedly as a personal finance community. And I saw how important like health was, right? Because immediately everything before that was irrelevant. The businesses he's built, the money he's made, the properties he's owned. Everything is irrelevant because now the most pressing problem was the disease. So 50 to 54, very poor quality of life. And then he left us at 54. Yeah.
You're saying 50 to 54, very poor quality of life. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the life quality that he had before that contributed to a cancer?
There was a lot of stress, definitely, as an entrepreneur, because the whole business was on him. He had mouths to feed, right? Two sons, a wife. various properties that he's purchased, he would need to pay the mortgages. There's a lot of innate desire to want more, because entrepreneurs always want more and more, and thereby doing more and more, late nights, trading. So I think there were elements of that. But I think the big one was really not knowing that there was a tumor growing in his brain until it was too late. So I think knowing earlier would help a lot, which is also where it's part of the inspiration of like why we're doing what we're doing in Mito Health. Yeah.
So obviously it impacted your main activity because it's what you're doing right now, right? But also how did this change your way of thinking about life in general?
Without health, there is no wealth. Yeah. So that's the big underlying motivation of what we do. We understand that wealth is this ladder that everyone climbs. But only recently, I would say within the last 3 to 5 years, you start realizing the people who have achieved wealth are moving all their efforts to health, right?
So you because it's almost like you get yourself to a miserable place to achieve wealth as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And then you realize, man,
yeah,
I have this money, but I feel like shit.
And not only you feel like shit, right? You can't spend it. So there's limited time to spend the amount of wealth you've created. So one school of thought is that how do you balance both enough? Because that is important, right? That is very, very important. And that's also why we focus on the younger audiences in our marketing.
So how do you balance wealth building, which you don't have to get there in 3 years. You have 30 years, 40 years, because you don't want to retire anyway. Otherwise, you're going to be bored.
Yeah.
How do you balance wealth building with health, keeping your health and thinking about that much earlier?
Yeah.
How good are you at that? Because you were talking about all this stuff, but you're building businesses, and we both know that when you build businesses, you can have all your best principles.
Yeah. And then you do the practical.
And then you're like, man, I'm again on the edge. Yeah. Fuck, I'm almost burning out.
Yeah.
Or I'm burnt out. Or, you know, like, so how do you balance this yourself, knowing all that stuff, preaching that stuff with your new business and having had this experience with your dad?
Yeah. So what is interesting was that the moment my dad got cancer, I realized how important insurance was, right? That's the first very big point. Yeah.
That's an amazing point.
Yeah.
We need to talk about that.
Okay.
Because
I'm
thinking about my ex-girlfriend, but probably a lot of people here, right?
Mm.
I'm like, do you have an insurance for the big stuff, right?
Mm.
Because, she's an actress, self-employed.
Mm.
So basically, you're an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Or I'm an entrepreneur. We need to have an insurance.
Mm-hmm.
I don't exactly know how it works for employees, if they have an insurance. Why is it so important for people? Why should it be a priority for people to have a health insurance?
Yeah.
Everyone should have a health insurance. Yeah. Why?
Yeah. In one line, insurance is the best investment that pays you the most when you need it the most, right? So let me break it down there. If you think about investments, you're always riding the wave, right? S&P 500, Bitcoin, crypto, Ethereum, right? Stocks like Tesla. You never know when it will pay you, right? So you never know when the dividends come. You never know when your growth stock is really going to grow. But insurance is the investment that you pay every year that pays you the most when you really need it the most. So if you frame it up, insurance generally pay out when there is a big problem or big disease that you have encountered. You get cancer, that's a payout. If you get heart attack, that's a payout. If you get into a car accident and you're in the hospital, there's also a payout, or they even pay for your bed, right? It's the bottom line, yeah. So in my previous life in personal finance, we always talk about insurance as a goalkeeper.
Mm.
No matter how many strikers you have, no matter how many Ronaldos, Messis, Mo Salahs you have, if you don't have a goalkeeper, a good goalkeeper, it's not about how many goals you score, but about the net score, right? How many goals you concede. So that's incredibly important.
Did your dad have an insurance?
Yes, which is why we didn't need to sell our homes. And that's a very real story.
Do you have examples of people mm-hmm. that you know or that you've heard of who had a cancer or a heart attack and had to sell their home?
It's very real because treatment is not cheap. And even in Singapore, where subsidized care is generally available, if you want private care, which is faster, quicker, better, more advanced in terms of chemo, radiation, and surgery, generally speaking, you need to pay a lot more. And what happens is, again, at that point, you realize that without health, there is no wealth. So if a loved one is starting to go through those phases and you start to realize that, you know what, I don't have enough to cover his surgery that by this top neurosurgeon or this top oncologist to do the cancer follow-up treatment, you tend to like, you know what, everything is not important, right? I need to gather the funds and pay for this treatment because I value this person's life. But that could have all been prevented if you value this person's life before all these things happen. Yeah.
Do you have some concrete numbers on like how much an operation for, obviously it depends on a cancer or a heart attack, but these things that happen much more than people think.
Yeah.
Because we see one person out of two will have cancer in their life.
Yeah, one of two to three.
Yeah, so I read woman, one out of two, men, one out of three.
Yeah.
Then I was like shocked. Then if you dig a bit deeper, it's because people are getting older and you are, but still, you're going to have a cancer. Yeah. Let's say you have one chance out of two to get a cancer.
Yeah.
Mm. How much do I spend? Just like some rough numbers. Yeah. So people think, fuck, do I even have this money somewhere? Yeah. Or am I going to actually lead my entire family, parents, children, brothers, sisters to ruin, financial ruin financial just ruin, because I'm not taking an insurance?
I can give a real example. So my dad's neurosurgery top doctor, like one surgery is $50,000 sing. Right. So put it in context, maybe it's about 30 to 35 grand USD.
Yeah.
And that's just the surgery. It doesn't include the wards. It doesn't include the chemo. Doesn't include the radiation that followed thereafter. And all those things were covered, thankfully, because of insurance. That's a big one. And even the what we call outpatient care. So outpatient is like the follow-up therapy. Mm. So he couldn't walk. He couldn't speak. He couldn't eat. So he had to have help. So some of this is covered by the government. There are policies for that, but a lot of it was insurance related. So very grateful for that.
So we're talking about hundreds of thousands, if not
hundreds
millions.
Hundreds of thousands, Hundreds of thousands is the average. Millions is if you want more advanced therapies. So there are more advanced therapies, even in Singapore and US, Hong Kong, where there's more advanced radiation techniques like gamma knife, right? You go very specific. There's precision oncology, which is becoming a big thing as well. So all those things are happening and all those things cost money. Yeah. Some insurance allows for those. Yeah.
What was your relationship with your parents when growing up?
Great, great. I think they were both working parents and they always catered time for my brother and I and always allowed us to fail, which is very different, I think, when it comes to most traditional Asian families where, you know, you have to do well in this area and then like do well in your studies, become a doctor, lawyer, which is a great path. But I think my mom and my dad allowed me to experiment with businesses. They funded my first company, failed horribly. And then the second one, we were out on the streets raising capital, but you sort of learn, you know, as you go along. So I think them putting in at first however much $1,000, right? So I think they gave us $10,000 like to try something out, failed. I paid it back to them over time. But yeah, I think that belief that it's okay to fail, right? And then you go out. Yeah.
Where do you think this was coming from? Because it's really not the way a lot of parents, I would say in general, and even less so in Asia.
Yeah. My mom was an engineer, so she was an electrical engineer, spent quite a bit of time in the States. So she understood innovation, and then she didn't understand the startup and mobile tech wave, but I think naturally that innovation in itself is a lot, it's building on failures, right? So even in the startup world, every day we are experiencing some form of failure. It's big, it's small, running out of money. It's all part and parcel of the process, right? Team members falling out, investors not wanting to continue to fund you, finding an alternative. Yeah, we would know this as entrepreneurs. Yeah. So it's a lot of failures.
Every day.
Every day.
Every second of the day.
Yeah.
So you grew up in Singapore and we talked about, I mean, you have parents who are very open-minded, mm-hmm. very lucky for that. I had a guest previously, she's called Simone Heng, and we talked about the Asian upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
Often pretty tough and how it's actually results in our generation
mm-hmm.
having more mental health issues than ever before because of how we're being raised.
Mm.
I mean, especially Asian people, right?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that as a smart dude who is building something in the health sector?
Yeah.
And more generally, how much do you think Singapore is doing a good job to kind of promote mental health and help people talk about their mental health issues?
Yeah, I think COVID was a big push for that because once, you know, we tend to forget this by now, but people were stuck at home for a long time during COVID. And I think it really showed how important mental health was because people were lonely, they were detached, there were little to no social interactions. So it opened the door for conversations around mental health. And I think most recently we are seeing more suicide, right, by youth. And yeah.
Continue. I have something to say regarding that.
Yeah.
Because when I came to challenge basically what you're saying, when I came to Singapore in 2021, I was thinking, oh man, Singapore mastered COVID.
No.
I mean, it was before the all these lockdowns. And exactly. Yeah. But I was thinking, oh, they mastered COVID. There is only 200 or 300 cases in the beginning, right?
Yeah.
What they were not saying at the same time.
Yeah.
You said COVID is good for, it was good to for these mental health things, right? What I kind of understood, or at least read, is that maybe Singapore had 300 cases of COVID, right? And zero death.
Mm.
But they were 10% of these 300 cases of COVID,
mm-hmm.
suicides, or even more. And they were not talking about the suicide. No one was talking about that. No newspaper, right? So it's, we mastered COVID, we're good, no one died. But actually there is many people who died from suicide because of these rules, right?
Yeah.
So do you really think Singapore is doing a decent job at talking about mental health issues? Or do you think they're trying, but there is also this Asian culture where it's a kind of a stigma to talk about mental health and suicide and all these things, which is happening a lot.
Yeah. I think the stigma definitely exists. Much like the stigma around money exists, much like the stigma around inheritance, around LGBTQ rights, like all these things still exist in pockets. Or rather in broad strokes, but I think in various communities, it could be in your company, it could be in our social circles, like people, I would say, would find ways to talk about their problems, to learn. So we ran a community, finance community. I'll talk about the stigma from a finance because it's sort of parallel to a thing that people don't talk about. And
Absolutely. And
not earning enough, high inflation rates, cost of living. We had a lot of anonymous questions and you would see how the community would rally around problems and give creative and constructive suggestions to help the individual online. And this was like peak COVID. So we started realizing people gathered online. We had frequent podcasts, meetups, online again, virtually, AMAs where people would come and then they would talk about their problems financially. So I'm not an expert in mental health, but when we look at the parallels, people, you know, divorce with two kids, how do you split up the custody of the kids? Like all these things were talked about quite a lot online.
Why is there a stigma around these themes? Why is, for example, let's take personal finance one.
Yeah.
Why is there a stigma in Asia or in Singapore at least?
Yeah.
Around personal finances and around money.
Yeah. There's this thing in the Chinese culture, in particularly, is called 面子, which is a face. So it's a lot of ego and perception that you should put forward a front that is a lot more well focused. So even if you know, like in Chinese New Year, all the greetings, in part, right, it's all about wealth. Like, you know, I wish you wealth, and then you wish me wealth. It's like it's not so much about health. It's usually more about health, our wealth. So it's about money. It's about making more money. So money is a very touchy topic, and a large chunk of it is growing up. You know, not everyone might have been as fortunate, so they would have earlier years where money is scarce. You grew up thinking you need to get a degree, to get a job, to earn a decent salary. So it's been inculcated since a very, very young age for a lot of people. Yeah. So that's culture.
Is it one of the reasons why you started Seedly?
Yes. We started it because it was not well spoken about in the community. So when we were started 8 years ago, the only real places to get information around money were very traditional financial bloggers. So on Blogspot and Tumblr and those. And not only those, right? You would get like forums like Hardware Zone, which is very trashy. So people would scream at each other. They would, it's those online forum bots, right? So then it's not very constructive. It's not designed well. And then there was a growth in terms of what we call finfluencers. Familiar with the term, financial influencers. Yep. So people who are willing to put themselves out there to say, this is how much I earn, this is how much I spend, this is how much I invest, this is how much I save.
Mostly through blogs?
Mostly through Instagram. So Instagram was picking up 7-8 years ago.
Already 7-8 years ago, people on Instagram saying, yep, okay, this is how much I, okay.
Yeah.
This is how I manage a budget, this is how I invest my money, this is how I'm going to... This entire FIRE...
Exactly. FIRE movement really started picking up. And the cool thing
was
that...
Can you explain what FIRE movement is?
Yeah. So financial independence, retire early. The goal is to amass enough wealth so that you have a very sustained income flow, so that you wouldn't have to think about your cost of living, right? It's all covered. You have a house. You have a roof over your head. You can take care of your basic necessities.
So it's almost a revolution... from youngsters against the you need to work until 65 or 70 or 67 or 64 depending on the country to retire.
Yep.
You can take control of your finances and future today and stop working at 30 or 35 or 40. And it doesn't mean you're going to become ultra rich. It's just understanding the basics of budgeting and making money, saving, investing a chunk of it, and then making sure that my nest egg at some point is big enough to cover my expenses that could be low, right, for the rest of my life.
Then so I draw down. Yep.
Exactly. So I can stop working earlier or work on something that is more meaningful to me or move somewhere else.
Yeah. And the cool thing in all of that is that 5 years ago, people were more and more open to talk about finances because it was no longer this thing where you could only get it from financial advisors. So this was a shift. Are you familiar with the concept buy term, invest the rest, BTR?
No.
So the concept around life insurance, there's usually two types. There's whole life and term life. So whole life, you pay a lot more premiums and then there's some stock value, cash value at the end of the day. Term life, you're just paying for protection. So you're paying for exactly, if you die today, what's the payout for you? At the end of the day, like maybe when you're 60, 70, there is no longer any cash value associated. So people started realizing that, hey, there is this vehicle that is designed for protection. So it's my goalkeeper. So now I can take that money, you know, and then with the rise of robo-advisors, it all came hand in hand. Robo-advisors offered the opportunity to invest in low-cost index funds that are globally diversified. So then with the marketing, with the upheaval of the financial do-it-yourself movement, finance became something that is very well talked about. We think the same will happen for health.
Mm.
Yeah. So that's long story short of like why we think that in health and mental health being one of them, cardiovascular health being another one, more and more people coming together to talk about biohacking. Like all these things are very ground up. It's very DIY, do it yourself. Yeah.
Are you a FIRE movement, I'd say fan, or are you part of this?
Yes.
Are you since a young age saying, how do I make money and invest so I can
Yes.
Not retire because you don't want to retire, especially if you're an entrepreneur, you would you would go crazy.
Yeah.
Having nothing to do and not having a bigger mission. But how are you personally doing on that stuff?
So having worked for 7-8 years, like I've personally amassed a decent amount of money, right? To be able to go into another startup. Because like not many people with liabilities in the early days, like kids, right? So kids, no matter what we talk about them, they're great, they're cuddly, but they cost a lot of money, right? Mm. So you have a kid, you have a house. The thing is not to overstretch yourself. So I live in public housing, right? So I live in a HDB BTO with my wife and we're happy, right? So we don't need to overstretch ourselves. There's no reason to do that. And the thing about FIRE is it's really that principle, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's not how I'm going to become a multimillionaire and retire early. It's more how can I live, how can I be smart about my money and live as simply as possible to be free as quickly as possible.
Exactly. Yeah.
You started Seedly right after university, if I'm not
wrong. In university.
Yeah. University, okay.
Yeah.
Do you think aspiring entrepreneurs should jump straight on the entrepreneurship train after uni, or do you think they should spend a few years getting some experience out there and maybe building a network before starting a business?
There's two schools of thought. So for my school of thought, I feel that if there is going to be more and more opportunity costs to starting later, then you should do it from day one. So the other path I could have taken is to join management consulting, investment banking, private banking, you know. So that's a very, very clear path, right? So it's a very clear defined path. But by going on to those paths, like you naturally have higher and higher opportunity costs because of your standard of living, your increased expenses, the social circles you would be around. So I made a decision very early on. I love startups. I love startups. Like 10 years in, I still love startups every day. It's just what problem are we solving, right? How do we really get things done, right? Don't just beat around the bush. Don't just talk, right? Just come together, do things. And that has been my belief. It might not work for everyone because some people would prefer stability. The risk appetite is not as strong. Yeah.
There's no such thing as stability in a startup.
Nope. Yeah. Roller coaster of emotions. Yeah.
It's interesting because I started my first company right after uni too at 23 years old.
Yeah.
And I had the same kind of same experience as you.
Yeah.
My parents helped me out for my first year.
Mm-hmm.
Like by helping me pay the flat. I was in London building the first business.
Yeah. We're lucky, right?
Super lucky with two other dudes.
Yeah.
Actually, I would even like say, instead of having your parents funding an MBA or whatever kind of master's, if they can fund you your first year.
You learn so much, right?
Yeah. Of entrepreneurship, just the basics, like a flat or a room, like a shit room somewhere and some shit food.
Yeah.
Like ramen. This is the best freaking investment they can do in yourself because the potential returns after that are limitless.
Yeah.
And I had the same thinking also. I was thinking, I was actually, before being in London, I was in Hong Kong and Singapore for some internships. And my idea was like you, I wanted to be a McKinsey consultant.
Yeah.
Why? I don't know. Because it's hard, you know? Like, it's hard. It's the hardest thing.
It's perceived to be hard.
Yeah, especially to get in there.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I was like, and then they tell you, you will get hired by a client and you have a good position, etc. Which makes a lot of sense, I think, still today.
Yeah.
But I was talking to these McKinsey consultants, I mean, previous Goldman Sachs bankers or previous McKinsey consultants who were 45 and now running a startup, right? You meet them everywhere in Singapore, in Hong Kong. It's very easy. You go out, you can randomly talk, and then they'll tell you, I'm building this company. I'm 43. I wish I had started my company when I was your age, 22.
Yeah.
And then you're like, I thought I wanted to go to McKinsey, but you're telling me that you wish you hadn't gone to McKinsey and you had started at my age. Mm? Yeah. What? And that's where I realized that this thing where you take basically no risk, especially if you have some support from your parents.
Yeah.
You take zero risks because you're starting right away. It's going to be very hard because you have no network. No one trusts you in terms of business.
Yeah.
So business connections, you have none, which is hard because you can have a lot of friends or a lot of people who have great, you know, jobs or who are very powerful. They're going to like you as a person, but they don't trust you in terms of business. So it's going to be useless. You have to prove yourself. Yeah. And when you're 22 or 23, no one kind of believes in you.
Yeah.
I mean, you need to have like that person who's going to believe in you, but still hard, but you don't take any risk. You don't have a family. You don't have, and you are not used to have a certain lifestyle yet. That comes with the McKinsey or whatever other type of salary, right?
Yeah.
So I had the exact same thinking and I was talking to my friends who were all in BCG, McKinsey, UBS, and like they would tell me, man, I'm earning a dad's salary, you know, like especially in Switzerland. I was in London, but like my friends, because I'm Swiss, they were in Switzerland working for McKinsey, making like first salary, $15K Sing dollar a month, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm making zero every month for the first year.
Negative.
And second year, I was so proud. I was like, oh, now we pay ourselves 1,850 pounds net per month.
Yeah.
Because there's a big difference between gross and net, especially in the UK, and especially when you earn that not much, right?
Yeah.
But I was like, man, I know it's the right thing to do because this
keeps you alive, right?
I realize I can live on very low means.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as I'm able to do that, I'm able to work on whatever I want and build something that's potentially much bigger later on.
Yeah.
So no-brainer.
Yeah, I would love to share a story as well. So it's one that with this recent medical startup, it's interesting because we had to convince a doctor to leave the public service to join us. And my co-founder or chief medical officer, Ryan, right? Like he would have been able to easily get a job as a specialist anywhere to set up a private practice, like his own GP. But it's interesting because after talking to him and really in depth, the way he rationalized it was that these opportunities will always be there.
Absolutely.
Right? And then that opportunity cost becomes so much bigger because how often would you have a chance to build something with great, smart people? And again, startups, you need to start things with people you feel like you can learn from. Mm-hmm. And I felt like very happy because it's very clear to him that this other lucrative path, he realized and rationalized that it's there. So this is a very natural decision to make because none of his peers would be able to do that.
Do you think he would have made the same decision at a much younger age coming out of, you know, I don't know how many years, 6, 7, 8 years of medicine is very hard.
Yeah, 7 years. Yeah.
So 7 years of medicine. And then you're like, oh, I'm just going to kind of ditch my 7 years of study to start something in the health tech field. Mm. Or do you think he would have been able to do that? Or is it because he's a certain age? He's like, I know what corporate medicine looks like, right? It's not going anywhere anyway. Mm-hmm. I can set up my own practice, but I'm also more mature to understand, like, I know what the doctor life looks like already, right?
Yeah, I think for this setup, definitely. So there's a lot of clarity in thought what the other paths might look like, right? And it's very different from someone coming out from school. So like when we came out from school, when we started, it was a very natural path. And quite honestly, when I share with you, is because when we started, investment was already, like, we were lucky and the networks compounded. So from my first earlier days of networking, we found investors. So the moment investors put in money, you have to start. Mm. So that was like the first startup where, or rather the Sidley, right? When we were in school, we were leaving school and then investors came in and said, okay, you know what? I'm going to fund you. You better start a company because I need to put the money somewhere, right? And then for you to try and make that into something. For this one, it's very much thought through, right? It's like, okay, there's this big problem we are trying to solve around preventative longevity health. Like, do we have the best skill sets? We think so. Do we have the best capital structure? We think so. Like, finding the best investors. Yeah, so to attack the problem.
What would you tell 20, 21, 22 years old student who studied 5 years law, for example, or accounting? Right? What most parents are very proud of, or medicine. What most parents are very proud of here, right?
Yeah.
Plus, you studied all these years, but now, today, I feel like I should be building a startup in music, which has nothing to do with my background, right? So I have two things. One is, my parents' pressure.
Yeah.
Again, in the world in general, probably even more here in Asia or in Singapore. And second, I even feel like I've kind of wasted my time the last 5 years. And it's, if I don't leverage what I've done in these studies for my future,
it feels wasted.
It's yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a kind of a sunk cost, you know. What would you tell them to do?
I would tell them to put together a business case. Yeah. So I did that as well with my parents, right? So if they are fortunate enough to be in those fields of study, highly likely they have parents who are pretty logical in terms of the way that they think through problems, the way they think through a fork in the road, right? So this is a fork in the road, right? It's, you close door A, you open door B. So put together a case, why is door B going to be way bigger an opportunity? What are the safety nets in door B? So for Asian parents, they love the concept of a safety net, right? What is the strike zone, right, of door B? So even if it doesn't work out, you could land yourself at a job at one of the big four consulting. Or
because you completed your master in accounting, for example.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So you got to give the scenarios, put together the case, talk about market, right? Like, why is this such an exciting market to build the music industry product? You've thought through, you've met enough people. So I think going in without a business case generally feels like a bad idea because parents in this part of the world are very logical, generally speaking. Yeah.
So you, Seedly, I think there was about at the top 1.1 million monthly users.
Yeah.
How did this turn out as a venture, the experience? What went well? What went wrong?
What went well? So overall, we knew we were very mission-driven. So the mission in Seedly was to make better financial decisions for everyone in the community, our readers, users, partners. So that meant that we could play the role of the connector. So the connector being that if a client or a user comes to us, we would tell them which is the best card to use, what is the best robo-advisor to use, brokerage, savings account. So that was consistent all the way through. And we had an exit to an e-commerce company. We divested to a financial group. So that was great for us, for the team. And the team made up quite well from that whole experience. I think what's not so good was in terms of certain strategic things we could have done better naturally. Hiring could have been better. Setting up the team structure, the capital structure could have been better so that we could actually decide various more options and not just be forced to certain options that we were going to choose at the end of the day. Yeah, so these things are very tactical. So you learn as you go and then you get better with every startup because this is going to be a long, long journey, right? You're not just going to start one company, you're going to start five, six companies, seven companies.
Why did you leave?
It was time. It was time to go. So 7 years in, we achieved what we wanted to do in Singapore. There wasn't really like a regional play because we joined a group that was regional in nature. So we had bases in Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore. And it was right time to hand over the reins to a new kind of successor to take the business forward. And I personally, I'm more of like a 0-1 guy. And most startup entrepreneurs are like that. They are not in it for like the 1-100. So either two things happen. They hire someone in to do that part of the business or they just leave and sell the business to someone else who could do that. Yeah.
What did you do after?
Took a break, a long break.
Why did you take a long break?
So we have aligned that this journey is crazy, right? In terms of the hours you put in. Like last night at 3 a.m., I was just thinking about problems to solve. So it's crazy. Like you can never really have a good night's rest. So I think that period was actually a very good period because it's really like there's no worries at all. You know, you have enough savings. You can draw down for X amount of months. So I took about 6 months off. And then traveled a bit, went to Europe. Went to a few conferences here and there, get inspired again. Get inspired like a child, right? So not like a, I'm in it because I have an agenda. I want to make a business partnership. I want to network with this person because just, you know, very pure, want to know people. I met so many different people in that time. really no agenda. Yeah.
Really no agenda?
Or just inspired. Want to be inspired. Yeah.
Or I'm going to take a break to find the what's my next big thing.
There's always that.
Somewhere.
It's always that. Yeah. But it's more latent. It's not.
It's more not, like I'm yeah. sleeping. It's like when we have an idea, but yeah. you sleep on it, right?
No,
like
there's no rush, no pressure.
So there was not like a 6 month kind of deadline. It's more like, okay, it's going to be more or less a few months, but I don't really know when.
Don't know where. Yeah. And I know a few people going through that now. So very top executives in startups, Series CD companies, and then they just took a break because they can afford to take a break. And it's very lucky to be able to do that. So you kind of need to be very conscious about taking a break. You know, it's a big thing about mental health is that you need to be conscious about those downtimes, be it in the day, right, late at night, or in your life, in your work life. After 2 years, you take a break. Yeah.
Says the one who thinks about work at 3 a.m.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
You need to be very conscious about the day, taking a break. The day, but not the night.
That's true. Yeah.
You did an Ironman during this break, right?
Yeah.
Why?
I met someone at in Switzerland, actually. So I was there for a conference, a Web3 conference, interestingly. And I went to the top of Pilatus, Mount Pilatus.
Yes.
And so there was this 60-year-old man who was doing a run. He ran up the mountain, one side of the mountain. And then I was sitting there at the top enjoying the view. And then it was quite crowded, so we had to share seats. So he was in his running gear. I was like, did you take the cable car up here or what? Like what? He said, oh, I parked on the other side. I ran up. He's like, I've done so many Ironmans. I've done ultra marathons. And I'm like 60. So
how did he look?
He looked good. He looked good. Yeah. He looked definitely not 60, right? Maybe 40s, late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very inspired. I was like, if I will want to do those things when I'm 60, I have to try to start doing them now. And there's no reason for me not to.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I'm addicted to challenge. I'm addicted to pain in some sense. So I decided that why not I give myself a challenge? The goal is to not die. The goal is to finish, right? So I did a 70.3. So it's half, but it's still a crazy kind of swim, bike, and run. And the distances really, like, you know, you would feel like 6 hours, 7 hours of a race, right?
How long did you prepare for that?
So I spent around 3 months. Yeah, so I
full time preparing on that.
Yeah, full time. So got a triathlon coach. Went to swim squat twice a week. Went to track squat twice a week. Had my own biking sessions on the weekend. I got my own bike. I got my own trainer at home. In terms of like the thing you attach onto the bike, so it's a bit safer than going on the roads. Yeah, so it's really all in. You set aside a budget. So I think setting aside budgets are crucial for this kind of endeavors as well. Yeah.
You told me you also did a Vipassana retreat.
Yes.
Was it during that time?
Yes, it was during that time. So it was exactly about a year ago, so September last year. And soon after I did it, I realized that many entrepreneurs reached out. Because when I talked about it, many different entrepreneurs started reaching out to us about the experience, what I learned.
So first, what is a Vipassana meditation and why did you do that?
So Vipassana meditation is a silent retreat. So it's a 10-day silent retreat. It can be done everywhere around the world. There are centers all over the world. And it's all almost pro bono. So it's a donation basis. You go there. There is no expectation of any amount that you pay. The food is provided. Accommodation is provided. Bathing facilities are provided. And you spend 10 days essentially just meditating and not talking to anyone. And the reason I did it is because my wife did it. Back then, girlfriend, she did it. In between jobs as well. Changed her life. Then my mom did it after my dad passed away. Changed her life as well in terms of how she thought about her problems. And then I wanted to do it because there isn't a better time in between jobs. Like, you don't have any commitments, no emails to check. Yeah.
Did it change your life?
Did it.
How?
So spending 10 days alone as an adult without talking to anyone, it's a very big challenge. And you start to realize how to think. So you learn how you think. And a lot of people don't understand what that means. But essentially, you start to realize what is going on in your brain from a very latent point of view and also a very a surface level point of view. So things where we system A, system B thinking, right? So reactive thought, right? So those are very natural top of mind, but you start to realize and you listen to that voice in your head. And that is the little voice that guides you in every single decision that compounds, right? Being at this podcast today, right? Not eating or eating certain foods, right? Or drinking, right? So all these things are habits that is because of the little voice in your head that you start to get comfortable with. It's hard, no doubt, but you learn a lot from being with yourself.
So you would say it's like going to this Vipassana meditation is like dissolving a lot of the things that you have in your mind and kind of understanding a lot more about how it works.
Yes. So the first 3 days is really just breathing in terms of like knowing how to breathe. And that's like a challenge because you do it so organically every day. So 3 days of just learning how to breathe again, that was eye-opening. And then the next 7 days was really like going deeper into like, why? Like, and it's non-religious. I think that's an important point to bring out. So there is nothing that is religion focused, but it's very much on like the self, sensation, meditation. Yeah. So everyone would have a bit of meditation, right? You use an app, you know, you've done a corporate workshop, but after you spend like a full 10 days with yourself, you start to realize how to think. Yeah.
Is it something that you keep inside of you or that you should repeat every year or every couple of years to understand again? For example, you did an Ironman, probably you looked really good. You were super fit.
I was, yeah.
But then if you don't continue to train, you can, you lose your fitness. Yeah. You can even become fat, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The same with the mind.
Yeah.
You can do all these things. You can spend 10 days doing a silent retreat, but probably you're going to forget how to catch your feelings and how your own kind of feelings and emotion system works after a while if you don't do it again.
Yeah. The recommended guideline is to do it every year, like a 10-day retreat every year. And again, in practice, to meditate every single morning and evening for 30 minutes.
Do you do that?
I don't. Yeah.
0 minutes or not 30 minutes?
Almost none.
Nothing?
Yeah, none.
Okay.
So the reality, again, in theory and practice is very different.
Yes.
Yeah, objectively.
Always.
Yeah. Being very real, right?
Yes.
So, but I would highly recommend everyone to try this at least once in their life because it's a challenge, right? It's almost like a diet you would go on. It's really like in terms of like a social media diet. No access to your phone. You don't talk to anyone for 10 days.
But you see people.
You just can't talk to people. You can't even look at them in the eye. So the goal is to not have eye contact.
What happens if you have an eye contact?
You quickly look away.
karma punishes you.
Yeah, you're like, yeah. So it's great for introverts. It's challenging for me being more of an extrovert. You know, I love to talk, to feel the silence, right? Yeah, so... You know, it's difficult to continue the practice every single day, but if I could, I would have gone every single year. But now with the baby, again, circumstance, but I'll definitely do it again in my life. Yeah.
Maybe we do it together next time. I'm very interested.
Yes. And it's everywhere around the world. So you could do one in Bali.
Where did you go?
I went to Korea.
Korea?
Korea. Amazing facilities. Shout out to the Korea.
Where is that? In a mountain somewhere?
Jeonju. Yeah. It's actually quite high up. But it's near to a farm, so it's nice, different.
What do you eat there?
Vegetarian, so no killing. Yeah,
only vegetarian because it helps you.
Yeah, helps you, and you lose weight. Presumably muscle mass as well, because you just sit there and meditate every day. But you know, you feel a lot cleaner in terms of thought, in terms of like the body systems, and you only eat 2 meals a day. Yeah.
How many meals a day do you eat now?
Now I've gone back to 3. So I used to do intermittent fasting for a while. But after a while, it's also difficult to keep up because of lifestyle, because of social with my family. We eat breakfast together. So in the end, I went back to 3 meals and tried to work out at least 3 times a week.
Have you ever tried fasting?
Yes.
For a prolonged period
one day,
of time?
Maximum 1 day.
24 hours.
Very cranky. Yeah.
Water, very cranky.
Very cranky, yeah.
In the beginning, that's normal.
Yeah.
I've done 9 days on water.
Yeah.
And I had a guest a few weeks ago who did, we talked about that. And I was like, you know, most people I say, I've done 5 days, 7 days, 9 days on water.
Yeah.
People are like, what? Are you crazy? And this dude was like, yeah, I've done 21 days.
Oh.
I was aiming 28, but after, at some point, you know, I wanted to eat.
Yeah.
So I ate after 21 days.
Okay.
And he said, my goal is 40 days. Maybe we can do it together. I was like,
yeah.
I'll think about it. The 10 days retreat, absolutely. The 40 days on water.
Yeah.
Probably not going to happen for me.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, it feels very not biologically natural. So after...
To stop eating? That's very interesting for someone who's in the health space.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of benefits to fasting.
Yeah, that's also
For me, it saved my life. It's amazing. I had a lot of... I had like a really...
Positives from the...
Yeah, and I had like 3 years like terrible disease and syndrome. And it really helped me. It was the first stepping stone of my recovery. A 7 day water fast, and then a 9 day water fast, and then a 5 day water fast with biohacking, taking herbs, nootropics to regenerate neuroplasticity and a bunch of stuff. Absolutely amazing.
Interesting.
Because of the autophagy process.
Yeah.
For your, could be immune, physical pain or mental health pain.
Okay.
Absolutely amazing. But not fun to do, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because the you know, eating is just such a social moment, as you said. And when you lack this social moment, your life becomes, I don't want to say empty, but kind of a bit sad, you know? Like, we unconsciously look forward to the dinner or the lunch.
Yeah, social,
because,
right?
Because it tastes good, it gives you dopamine, but also because what else do I do otherwise?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm just going to work more. Oh, I'm going to... Where is my kind of break, you know? Yeah. There's none. So people say, oh, it's much better. It makes me more productive. You need to sleep much less. Also, you sleep 4 or 5 hours, you're good.
Yep.
Because you don't, you know, 50% of your energy is used for digestion.
Mm.
So if you don't eat, you have twice as much energy to not only live your life, but also perform better, but also heal yourself, right? Yep. That's why it's so amazing. But it's a bit sad. It's a bit sad.
Yeah.
You talked about biohacking.
Mm-hmm. What's the definition, right? I guess everyone. Absolutely. Yeah, everyone has a definition of biohacking.
What have you learned about biohacking, and how does it kind of fit into what you guys are doing with Mito Health?
So my earlier versions of biohacking when I was working on the finance startup was weight loss, right? So I've naturally been a very big guy, right? So from young, always very 90th percentile in terms of weight. Lost a lot of it when I went to the army and then tried to keep it off. But naturally, I'm quite big. So weight loss has always been my version of biohacking. So anything related to that, like keto, I was trying paleo, I was trying calisthenics, like all this were my versions. Because biohacking is very different, right? For you, if it's mental, then the techniques for mental biohacking would be very different. Yeah, so that's earlier days. But right now, the way that we are very focused on is really preventative health. So it's not so much the traditional way of biohacking, but it's around extending health span. So that has been like the main mission and thesis of what we do as a business at Mito Health.
What's the mission in one sentence?
Yeah, we want to extend health spans of the population, right? So that's the massive vision. Like health span extension is key to everything that we do. So every diagnostic we do, every intervention we do is around extending health span.
What does health span mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because we have something called lifespan, which is I live longer.
Yeah.
But I don't want to live longer if I feel like crap or if I'm not healthy, right?
Exactly.
So what is health span?
So if we imagine it as a curve, right? Health span is like the years that are free from disease, right? So it could be cancer, it could be heart attack, stroke, could be Alzheimer's, dementia, or metabolic syndrome like diabetes, right? So the moment you would contract any of this one disease, your curve just shifts down below the 50% line. So 50% quality of life, as explained with my own father, was very bad, right? You can't eat on your own. You can't change your clothes on your own. You can't move on your own. You have to be in a wheelchair. It's not a great place to be, right? In terms of quality of life. So by keeping people healthy for longer is the idea of a health span. So a health span might be 60 years, but your lifespan might be 63 years. So the last 3 years might not be in the best quality of life. Because you don't want to live to 63, example. And then like from 30 to 63, you're in like a below 50% of your quality of life. That's not what we want to do. We want to keep people healthy for longer. That's health span. Yeah.
Before continuing on the mito health and the health span subject, because you talked about your dad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something that people say at work, I mean, in life in general, they say there is the work version, I mean, less and less, but there's the work version of yourself and then there is the life, personal life, right? And it's separate. Our generation, we're more realizing that it's all one person.
Yes.
I'm absolutely terrible at splitting both.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, if I have a girlfriend and we're having issues, it's going to fuck up my mental health and brain so much that
business suffers.
I'm like, fuck the business. Like, because you know, as a man, you're like, I need to solve a problem. What's the biggest issue? Yeah. If the business goes more or less well, like problem, girlfriend problem or issue. But then like, so like managing, for me at least, managing multiple things at the same time, you prioritize and then the rest is like pretty much not taken care of until the priority is sorted.
Yeah.
How the hell do you build a business when your father is going through cancer and is in such a bad place?
Yeah, not great. So I think that I have to really thank my mom and my brother who did a lot of the heavy lifting. Because I think as a family unit, you know, you come together to like help each other at different points in time. So I think our families were very understanding. Like my family was very understanding that I was dealing with problems at work every day, but also, you know, was dealing with like a family issue. So they were stepping up to help out. And my then girlfriend, wife as well, was very understanding in that scenario. But yeah, I think it's not easy. So whoever is going through a very tough time with your family and also running a business, I understand how you feel. Just hang in there. It will get better. It's a phase. You just always have to remember that it's a phase. Things will get better either way, right? Either, you know, one story ends, another starts again. Yeah, it will get better. Yeah.
What's the size of the challenge with Mito Health?
The size of the challenge is 8 billion people, right? That's a way to frame it. So 8 billion people are aging. So that's the population of the world today. So the 8 billion people who are aging, and we think that there will be a silver tsunami of what we are seeing in Japan and Singapore across the world very soon. So, yeah.
Which is?
So the tsunami basically represents the shift in demographic of older people to younger people, right? So people who are beyond 40, 50 years old will soon be a larger population than the people who are younger. Right. And it's very natural, because as if you check out the global stats, you can actually go online and search the world population. You can look at the amount of deaths and the amount of births every day. Yeah, there are a lot more births than there are deaths, because people are living longer and longer. Quality of life might not be great, but people are living longer. And what that means is that the population starts to expand across the world, and there will be a lot of sick people that we need to take care of, right?
So the population is extending.
Yeah.
There's more and more people.
Yeah.
Because if you listen to a lot of very smart people, Elon Musk included, there is actually not enough children.
Yeah.
There's not enough babies.
Yeah.
And we probably going to plateau around 9 billion people. And that's a catastrophe for humans, because we're not reproducing at the fast pace enough.
There is the projection of that. But what if you look at the today's situation of like health span and lifespans, the immediate problem that I see beyond the population of the world not being sufficient to sustain life and stuff is the shift in the demographic. So I'm more concerned about that, because if you look at the strain on healthcare systems, it's actually not sustainable. So what we need to do is to move upstream. We can't just treat people when they're ill or when they're sick. We need to look at preventative methods. We need to look at longevity biomarkers before this becomes such a big issue.
Yeah. Do you think people actually care about that?
Well, for now, the interesting start for us is really the executives. So we are targeting executives because executives are the ones who realize that health is wealth. So that's our start, that's our beachhead market. Yeah. So people who earn a decent amount and they realize that without health, there is no wealth, right? So we start with those who are willing to pay. So we have paying clients, very happy. We are helping them optimize their health span by looking at their biomarkers, interventions, supplements, nutrition, workouts. And then the goal from this is to learn enough so that we could build the next version that is more downstream and more downstream. I think every kind of customer profiles would require different kind of messaging, different kind of feature sets to allow them to have the same ideal outcome of extending health span. Yeah.
We talked about us being at university and wanting to become a consultant, right? Or accountants. There's something we call the big four in accounting.
Mm-hmm.
PwC, yeah. KPMG, EY,
yeah.
And Deloitte, yeah. Right? But there's also something we call the big four in health.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, something you call the big four, which are the four things or diseases that kill the most people today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are these big four?
Yeah. So it's popularized by Peter Thiel from the book Outlive, right? So we subscribe to that. So the idea, the first thing is actually cardiovascular problems like heart attack and stroke. So that's a big one. So it's to do with your heart. Second one being cancer. So cancer, we already align one out of 2 to 3 people would get cancer in their lifetimes, early stage or late stage. The third one being metabolic syndrome. So metabolic syndrome would be problems like type 2 diabetes, which is diabetes that is not inherited, is by being insulin resistant. And then the fourth one is neurodegenerative problems like Alzheimer's and dementia. So very key body systems in any human. The moment you get one of these four, it's highly likely that your mortality and death becomes a lot nearer. Yeah.
Insulin resistance?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
That means that your body can't create enough insulin to keep your glucose levels down, and that creates havoc in all your different body parts, your kidneys, your livers. And it's because of overconsumption of glucose or sweets. Yeah. And then it's type 2 diabetes. Yeah. So those things we track as well.
So that's an interesting one because now back to, I mean, you said now you're talking to executives.
Mm-hmm.
Probably these people are already doing some gym and thinking about their health, right?
Mm-hmm.
But now let's look at everyone else,
mm-hmm.
right? You are a Singaporean, right?
Yeah.
Do you think that the traditional meals that are prepared by loving aunties in the Asian household
mm-hmm.
are good at preventing diabetes, one of the diseases that kills the most people today?
Yeah. Well, it's a tough question because on the one hand, they're so delicious most of the time. But on the other hand, I do think it's also in balance. So, you know, you can have a great meal today in terms of like the quality and quantity might be very unhealthy, but on the other days you compensate for that. So I think it's more like finding that balance, and everyone has a different balance. And the government is doing a lot. So they are making, if you watch the Blue Zones there, one of the big themes there was about making healthy the default option. And that's interesting because healthy the default option, meaning that every time you go to a hawker, there is a lower cost product that is actually healthy. So in different parts of the world, the lower cost product is naturally the more unhealthy ones. But locally, the government is actually funding like brown rice, like vermicelli, like all these products are actually discounted because they wanted to make it the default option. So it's easy to get a healthy meal for affordable price at a hawker actually.
So you are saying that mm-hmm. in Singapore,
yeah.
the government is kind of subsidizing brown rice or other sort of healthy options to hawker centers
mm-hmm.
so that people
choose
don't even have an excuse
yeah.
to say it's too expensive to eat healthy.
Exactly.
Is there a certain type of hawkers where you have like a certification of like
yeah.
health,
yeah.
you know?
And so there is the healthier choice. So that one is where you see a pyramid that tells you that it's healthier to eat brown or red rice versus white rice. So that's one example. Another example is the Nutri-Grading. So that just came out this year. So if you visit the supermarket, whole milk like might be graded C, but a low-fat skim milk might be graded B. So it's easy to know.
But every hawker today is subsidized by the government.
Yeah.
I can go to any random hawker place and think and not have to worry too much about...
You have to look for the option. Yeah,
okay.
The option is there, but it again, like what you said, it's default. It's like there is no reason to say like, oh no, I need to buy a salad. No, you don't need to buy a salad. Like you can go to what we call a mixed rice shop. So you can just choose brown rice, vegetables, and stir-fry vegetables, lower fat, lower oil. They are all available there. You can get eggs for maybe $3, $4. You don't need like a salad that costs $12. Yeah. The macros are similar, you know? Yeah.
So there is this thing there, but there is still the traditions, which is meals. I mean, it depends on the culture. There's different culture in Singapore. But if you think about Chinese or Malay or like all these very rich foods.
Yeah, coconut oil, coconut milk. Yeah.
Where you might also almost be seen as I've been criticized already by my previous girlfriend.
Yeah,
you don't adapt to local culture. When I was in my early 20s, I lived in Shanghai, Hong Kong, Singapore, and I was eating in hawker center all the time, right?
Yeah.
But now I eat mega healthy.
Yeah.
And for me, mega healthy is basically what's boring for most people, you know, chicken breast, brown rice.
Yeah.
I don't count everything anymore, but I used to count 2 years ago, macros and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So there is this big clash of like, for me, there's still a big clash between like actual health and culture and traditional food that are very rich. And if you look at, because you're in the longevity space, people who are really focused on that go to the very extreme, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you said, you talked about balance, which is probably like more healthy for most people in terms of like how they think. But if you really want to optimize your health span, as you called it, right? It's probably good to be more extreme than not. Because we all know that the problem is the human brain is, I'm not going to drink Coke, right? Yeah. But then I drink Coke one day because, oh, why not?
Yeah.
The problem is the day after, I want my Coke.
Yeah.
I want it. I feel the sugar.
Yeah.
The
high.
The same as the coffee.
Same it's as different, the coffee,
but like you want it, right? So I want to have the sweet and sour pork, right? Or chicken or like, because it tastes good. Like it tastes much better than a chicken breast with brown rice with zero sauce on the top, right?
Mm.
So is it even possible, right? Especially given how food is kind of ingrained in the culture.
Culture, yeah. It is challenging, no doubt. But I think it's again, goes back to what your priorities are. So I guess if you are younger, you know, if you have a bit more what we call reserves. So we like to talk about reserves. So muscle reserves, cognitive reserves. So if your reserves are more, you have more caloric deficit, like you can actually consume more because your basal metabolism is higher. Then I think go for it, right? You need to try that curry chicken in once in your life, twice. I mean, you don't do it every day, because if you do it every day, then naturally it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy of a bad habit. But once in a while...
For example, in gym, right?
Yeah.
There's the cheat day.
Cheat day.
Is it how people should look at that? They say the cheat day is I'm going to have that nice chicken curry.
Yeah.
But only once a week? Or is it like... how should people concretely approach this?
Yeah, so there are studies that show that if we start off with the mentality of the cheat day, it's probably not going to sustain. I'm sure you read those as well. So like mentally, if you go in, you know, 7 days, one day a week, you want to eat all you want, it's not going to be sustainable. So the approach here is like, how do you look at replacements, right? So instead of having that sugary drink, how do you replace that sugary drink with sparkling water?
Kombucha.
Right. Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
Kombucha is the best freaking way to replace any soda.
Yeah. Recently, I've tried this probiotic, pro and postbiotic soda.
Yeah.
So zero calories. So they put stevia and some replacements, but it's fizzy. So it tastes nice and there is probiotics in the soda. So that's another way to replace. So, okay, that's more expensive. Granted, yeah, that is definitely more expensive. Yeah.
Okay, that's very interesting because you talk about stevia, right?
Yeah,
which is a good way to replace sugar.
Yeah,
but if you, because the problem is like the rabbit hole is endless online.
Yeah,
I can replace this with that, but this thing also has another problem. For example, if I drink Coke Zero instead of drinking normal Coke, I'm not going to have my 15 or 34 sugar pieces in there, right? But I'm going to have some other type of product that actually are very bad for testosterone.
Mm.
And then you start to think, I've been through this journey and I'm like, I'm drinking only Diet Coke now because 2 years ago I was counting my macros and everything, right? But then I learned later that this is not good for my testosterone level, which is very important. So I'm like, do I choose the sugar or do I choose the testosterone? Oh, I'm probably going to choose the sugar. And it's kind of endless.
Yeah.
And also there is a theory for everything, right? Yeah. There is a kind of like data supporting every opinion online. That's a very big challenge. So like, how do people think about all this stuff and not get, you know, we always say paralysis by analysis.
Yeah, yeah. The way we approach it at Mito and personally as well is to experiment, right? So you experiment, you take this for A-B tests, right? So you take this for your own, use some wearables, right? Track your weight, you know, track your sleep, HRV levels, sleep cycles, and these things help, right? So over time, you find what replaces the best for you. I'll give you one real example. So I love watching football and having a bag of chips. I used to love it
so
a lot.
So good.
Right?
The natural one with just the salt.
Yeah, that is.
Or do you like the one with like the weird shit taste?
Yeah, the black pepper, sea salt. So I love those, but I realized that the replacement to that is actually popcorn. So popcorn that is sea salt popcorn. Coconut oil and sea salt popcorn. So there's this one that is a blue bear, if you've seen it in the shelves. And you look at the calories, it's definitely like 1/5. And it gives the same feeling of having that. So that I find is a lot better because it replaces the same craving at a much lower cost.
Understand.
Yeah, so that is the approach.
Cost for health.
Yeah. It's more expensive, you're right. It's more expensive, yeah. So that, I agree, some are more expensive. No. The research shows also, right? Like, there is no amount of alcohol that is good.
What does it show?
Exactly. So the one that I read, I can't remember the exact research paper, but basically no amount of alcohol is good, like at all. So even though, you know, you read things like Blue Zones, if you watch the Blue Zones thing.
I didn't watch it, but everybody talks about it.
Yeah. So there's this phrase there's this study that says wine every day at 5 p.m. That leads to longevity.
Yeah.
But that's very anecdotal, right? So you're just looking at people in where is that place? Okinawa in Japan. You're looking at somewhere in Italy, somewhere in Greece, Ikaria, right?
Yeah.
And then
they talk about Singapore too.
They talk about Singapore. Yeah, I think we are the sixth blue zone. It's good though.
Do you know why?
Yeah. The medical system is very well built. Yeah. And it's really taking care of you all the way to when you're old. And there's a lot of nuances to that. I mean, some examples personally is that for the guys, we are all expected to maintain some level of fitness all the way till we're 40. Yeah, because of the military and stuff. Yeah.
Okay, so what does that mean? It means like, because you have to be in military until 40?
Yeah, every year we go back for 2 weeks.
It's 2 weeks.
Two weeks.
Until 40?
Until 40, at least. So for some people, it's until 50.
Even if you do, so you do what, 2 years?
2 years.
And then you do 2 weeks every year.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wow, because in Switzerland it's...
Oh, it's required as well. Yeah,
it's required, exactly. Yeah. But it's either you do...
A lot more in the front.
I think it's like you do 11 months.
11 months.
But I think because I didn't do it, I skipped it.
Oh.
But anyway, I think it's 11 months or 12, like up front.
Yeah.
And then you're pretty much done and maybe like you have 2 weeks or 1 week every year.
Okay.
Until 30.
30. That's
or
very
you
fast.
Do six months and then you have more to do every year until 30, but it's actually until 30. That's interesting. Regarding the drinking, it's really interesting because I remember my mother, she was always telling me, we're talking about the Queen of England.
Mm-hmm.
And she was kind of not really famous for drinking one glass of red wine every day.
Yeah.
And that's the reason why she would go on to live.
Yeah, long, know, until 90s, like, right? Yeah.
I think it might be 100.
Okay.
And so I kind of like have this kind of myth also in my mind.
Yeah.
But if you, exactly, if you read studies and if you just do the experiment with yourself.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, of not drinking for a month or 2 months or, yeah, 6 months.
Yeah.
You realize that alcohol is, yeah, basically poison.
Yeah, it,
like,
is.
It's poison. It is. And like, yeah, why would you do that to yourself? I mean, it's cool. For me, I'm not against a few glasses of wine here and there.
But yeah,
the, you know, the heavy drinking that you,
no,
that you would do in your,
yeah,
early 20s.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even understand, yeah, like why we would. It, because it tastes so bad. Yeah. Just the taste is so bad. Why do that to yourself, you know?
We have clients. I mean, this a bit on the work that we do, but we actually see the values in the liver scores. So the AST, ALT biomarkers that shows early fatty liver disease. Yeah, it shows up based on their lifestyle habits.
How do you measure that?
Exactly. It's in the blood. It's in the blood.
Yeah, but yeah, what do you... How can you say, okay... you drink that many times a week?
Yeah. Yeah.
And therefore, at this age, oh, now we can measure that?
Yeah.
Or is it more, if you stop now, after 6 months or 1 year or a few months, we'll see a difference?
It's usually the first one. So it's because of the heavy drinking, and then it leads to like scarring of your liver.
Okay.
That has irreversible damage potentially.
Can you not reverse that?
It's difficult to. Yeah, it's difficult to, because once the liver is scarred, it's generally quite difficult to unscar the liver. But what we generally recommend our clients is to know whether it's their values are in order. So that is part of like the biomarkers we test for generally. But it shows you, right? It shows you that by heavy drinking, like it does lead to such liver disease, early liver disease.
What do you mean by heavy drinking?
Yeah, more than, so we have a criteria. So less than 5 units a week is okay, generally.
What's a unit?
Unit is less than half a pint. Yeah, there's a specific definition. So less than half a pint. 1 pint is not 1 unit. Yeah.
So 2.5 pints.
2.5
a
pint
week
is
5 units.
Five thereabouts. Yeah.
Therefore, that's heavy drinking.
No, that's actually low. More than 14 is heavy.
More
so
than 14.
Almost 14, yeah. So that's about 7 pints, more than 7 pints.
So one per day.
And it's actually worse if you do all 7 pints on 1 day. There's also research to show
it's
that.
It's worse than if you do one per day.
Yeah, yeah. It's worse than if you do one per day. Yeah.
I mean, it's not an encouragement for anyone out there to just like drink every day instead of like once a day.
Exactly. Yeah. But I think it's worth noting that all these lifestyle choices add up, right? It compounds, like how much sleep you're getting as well. All these things actually matter quite a lot.
And they're all interconnected.
Yeah.
Because
if
you drink, you're going to sleep much less well.
You are familiar with the HRV, your scores. You have wearables that track your sleep scores as well. You can do a simple experiment. The amount of alcohol or caffeine even, like caffeine, alcohol, that you drink prior to your sleep, how does that affect your sleep scores? And you can A/B test over time. Yeah.
Can you talk about the caffeine one? It's really really interesting one, because I have some friends who tell me I can drink as many coffee as I want.
Yeah.
It's not going to affect my sleep. I can drink
coffee or
coffee just before sleeping.
Yeah.
It's not affecting my sleep. And usually these people.
Yeah.
Have crazy anxiety problems already.
Yeah.
And they can't even link one to the other.
Mm.
Not even talking about the sleep itself.
Yeah.
Like if you have anxiety problem, don't drink alcohol, don't drink coffee.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I love coffee. Fine. So how does coffee and caffeine affect sleep?
Yeah.
And is there such thing as people who are not affected in their sleep by caffeine?
Yeah. I think there's two ways to look at it. Like the first way is that there's actually genetic studies you can do to figure out whether you are more predisposed to caffeine sensitivity versus other people. That's one way in terms of nutrition. The other way is actually to do an experiment, right? So the general rule of thumb is to not drink beyond 3 p.m. 3 p.m., right? Or 6 hours before you sleep, right? So it's either or, depending on what time you sleep. So the best time to sleep is 9 p.m., right?
Okay, a few things Why 6 hours?
Yeah.
Because of half-life? Or like how do...
I don't have the specifics. Okay. Yeah.
And why 9 p.m.?
9 p.m., I mean, you have to go through the different sleep stages. Mm. So if you're familiar with the sleep stages, light sleep, deep sleep, REM sleep, and awake. And then we go in cycles. So I track my sleep using an Oura ring and a Garmin watch. So every morning when I wake up, it's a bit of a habit. I look at what my score is. And generally speaking, it's true that if I drink coffee late in the day because of work or just because of habit, it's not great.
Because we're a bit addicted.
Addicted, yeah. Caffeine is a drug.
It's very addictive.
It's a drug. Yeah,
absolutely.
It is. Yeah. And it tastes nice.
It tastes nice and it's very addictive. Like you remove caffeine.
Yeah.
You tell people, try stop drinking for a month or 2 months or 3 months.
Yeah.
You're like, okay, yeah, no problem. Probably won't manage to do it, but it's fine.
Yeah.
Try telling them, try to remove caffeine for a week, not a month. Are you crazy? I love my coffee. It makes me feel so happy. And so we're completely addicted to this.
Yeah.
Me included. I have only one per day, but like it's like just thinking one day, I'm going to remove caffeine today. I can definitely do it, but like there is like this lack. There's this lack.
Yeah, exactly.
It's bad.
Yeah.
It's bad, especially because caffeine, people say, there's a lot of positive side effects, etc. But like there's also, it's also a very strong, actually nootropic that creates a lot of problems to sleep and anxiety for people. So.
Yeah, so I think you have to understand yourself at the end of the day, like how it affects it affects everyone differently. So for me, I take it twice. I drink 2 cups of coffee a day. So one in the morning, one usually after lunch when the after lunch slump comes.
Mm.
And so far, it's just for me personally, before 3 p.m., it's fine. And my sleep scores hold up. I go through enough cycles, sleep cycles. So yeah, that's...
How long do you sleep per night?
Now with a baby, it's hard.
Mm.
Yeah, because I wake up every 3 a.m. But in the past, from 10 p.m. all the way to 7. So it's quite a decent amount of...
Wow.
At least...
That's also
10 hours. Yeah, 9 hours. Mean, yeah.
9 hours in the bed or sleep time?
In the bed. Okay. Yeah, in the bed. So maybe I take around 15, 20 minutes to sleep. Roll around a little, sleep routine. So something interesting. Right now we have a baby and we realize that we got a sleep coach for him. Sleep coach. Yeah, it's a very common thing for parents right now. And you never thought about it, but the same things applies since we are babies. The concept of sleep training, right? The environment we are sleeping in.
Mm.
The words you use to tell him to sleep. And not only that, right? Yeah, it's very interesting. And you start to realize that we are conditioned from a very young age to sleep. And sleep is a large chunk of our life. And a lot of people tend to forget this down the road as well.
A lot of people put sleep secondary to everything.
Yeah.
I need to wake up, I need to work and all that stuff. When if your sleep pattern is not in check or I would say even mastered the rest of your day and therefore the rest of your life is not going to be mastered and in check at all because you can't think straight when you're underslept.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And too many people just don't understand that.
Yeah.
Or at least when you're young, you don't understand that and you're like, start to realize, man, like if I want to be productive and do some useful things with my days and my life, I'd rather understand how to sleep better.
Yeah. So sleep, we always measure in two ways, quantity and quality. So the way to measure quantity is easy, is the amount of time in bed. But the quality one is the big one. So it's like, do you wake up feeling refreshed? Do you not wake up feeling refreshed? So that's a nice proxy for a sleep score. And we always tell our clients, right, lack of sleep is actually carcinogenic. Like there are research to show that it is carcinogenic.
Meaning it gives you cancer?
Yeah, it could give you cancer because not enough recovery, your cells are not recharging. So then it can lead potentially to cancer. Yeah.
So how, for example, for me, I mean, for you too, you're an entrepreneur, right?
Mm-hmm.
So technically, I mean, you have teams who rely on you, but technically you can wake up whenever you want in the morning if you don't have meetings in the morning.
Yeah.
So it's kind of easier to say, I'll sleep until I wake up and feel refreshed. I wake up, I feel like, I've got hit by a truck. I can still sleep a bit more.
Yeah.
Because you know that it's not the input that matters to your output, day. Yeah. It's the output. It's not like I have to be 8 hours at work. It's I have to get shit done. So I'd rather spend a bit less time working or working later, but get shit done. So I can sleep longer, right?
Yeah.
Now, for people who have the classic lifestyle, which is I need to be at work at 9 a.m. There's this additional kind of unconscious pressure on, like, I need to sleep now or better. You know, I need to sleep well, but I have this kind of time constraint. How do you do, what do you recommend for people who have this, they who need to show up at a certain time to still wake up fresh despite the constraint of time?
I believe in the concept of the circadian rhythm, which you are familiar probably with the concept of sleep. So you can actually adjust it over time. And it's the same thing we see in babies. Like when the babies go to sleep at certain time, let's say, so they sleep at around 7 to 8 p.m. every night. And then they wake up all the way at 6 a.m. So they really sleep a long time. Maybe there's a feed one or two times in the night where they get hungry because their stomachs are not big enough. Same for adults. You realize that after a while, you can condition your body to sleep at a certain time and to wake up at a certain time. And then you would get enough sleep cycles within that time period.
What's a while?
Sorry?
You said after a while?
After a while.
What does that mean?
It depends.
The classic 21 days to change a habit? Is it...
Depends, yeah. So like, for example, when people travel into a different time zone, it takes them 3 days to be adapted to that time zone, right? Because if not, you'll be waking up at strange times in the night. Like I have trouble adopting to European time zones when I fly there.
Is there a such thing as it takes a certain amount of days by hours of time difference? Because I don't know, because you're saying like 3 days. For example, if I go to Europe, honestly, I love it because...
You adapt quickly to the...
The thing zone. Is, it makes me, it forces me, I'm not someone who wakes up very early in the morning. So it kind of, I wake up naturally early because I go there. And, you know, let's say there's 6 hours time difference now with Switzerland. So if I go to Switzerland now, I'm going to wake up, if it's here 1 p.m., if it's here 12, it's going to be 6 a.m. there. So I'll wake up naturally anyway at 6 and I will have plenty of sleep because it's the equivalent of 12 here, right?
Yeah.
So it's fine. When I come back to Asia, every time I need a week.
Yeah.
A week at least, like because my condition, brain doesn't really understand at all what's happening there.
Yeah. I feel there's an aging element to it. I don't know. It's not research back, but when I was younger, it was easier. And then as you start to age, you kind of these things start to take a bit longer and longer time. It's same for exercise. When I gym now, the time after training, the recovery time and the DOMS, right? Like the delayed onset of muscle soreness, it comes in harder, like for some reason. Yeah.
Is there something you recommend for people who travel a lot and experience a lot of jet lag to recover from jet lag faster?
There is a way, which is something that I personally do, but I don't recommend, which is melatonin. So actually by taking melatonin personally, I realized that it helps my body get into, even though it's artificial, right? It's almost like a nootropic. It tells your brain, it's a synthetic hormone, right? To create that feeling of feeling tired. And then you go to bed and it helps.
When do you take it? Once you're back or already before?
When I'm supposed to sleep. So within like 15 minutes, I feel really, really tired. And you can get it off the shelf also. And then I find it works for me. It might not work for other people. Then I feel like, okay, it's time to sleep. And then usually when you wake up, it's really, really crappy, but it shortens the time to adjust. In my view,
One thing I do is for a lot of different things, but for that one too, acupuncture. Acupuncture is amazing for so many things, but one of them is every time you feel out of whack or you feel like your body's imbalanced, you just do it, and jet lag is completely an imbalance in your body. So you go
here,
once.
Right? In Singapore or what?
Everywhere I go, I go to acupuncture.
Wow.
I love it. I'm a needle addict.
Interesting.
Actually,
maybe it's the same thing with tattoo, right? Like maybe it's the same thing like...
With tattoo?
I've done acupunctures twice. I've never done tattoo, but I know that people when they do, like, there's some pain involved, and then you
feel did you feel pain in acupuncture?
I do. Maybe it's not a good acupuncturist.
Okay, yeah. Interesting. I mean, sometimes you feel some things, but I never experienced, like, real, like, sharp pain. Okay. It's more like a lifesaver for me.
Nice.
We talked about cancer before.
Yeah.
And we said one out of two or three person will basically have cancer during their life. We talked about that in the context of the insurance. Let's talk about that in the context of the prevention.
Mm-hmm.
What can people do to prevent cancer?
So I think prevention comes from a few things. I think the ones that we feel as a company the most important are like lifestyle factors. So sleep and smoking. So people will always think like, oh, it's some diagnostics and stuff. But smoking is the very low hanging fruit to not smoke to in order to bring down your risk of cancer by 2 to 3 times. Like that's proven. And not only cancer, right? All your different horsemen that we talked about earlier.
And not only lung cancer.
No, yeah.
Any type of cancer.
It's carcinogenic, right? Yeah. So it affects all of your cells and the people around you because secondhand smoke is proven to increase the prevalence of cancer. Yeah. So that's one.
What about the elephant in the room?
Mm-hmm?
Vaping. Everybody now thinks, oh, it's okay. I stopped smoking. I'm vaping. It's okay. Forbidden in Singapore, everybody.
Yeah.
It tastes good, it's different, blah, blah, blah. What about vaping and cancer?
Yeah. I don't have enough research to back any of those, but I can see it similar to how people are looking at the replacement, right? So I think like for like, my understanding, this is not medically backed. My understanding is that it's less dangerous based on the nicotine. There is no tar. Right, because it's not smoke. But my understanding is still addictive. It's still not good for your lungs. That's my very basic understanding. I don't have...
And medical, we don't know the potential effects it can have.
It's very new, right? It's like e-cigarettes. I mean, they have been around for what? 4 years? Three, 4 years now? Since like, I think start of COVID. So very new. Many people are doing it.
Can't be good. Because the cigarette...
Yeah.
You smoke a cigarette every now and then. The freaking vape. Mm. Is all day long and some people even in the bed.
Oh, like, wow.
They all say, the difference, the cigarette, you're done with the cigarette, it's done, right? You take another one, right?
It just keeps going, right?
And also you can't smoke inside.
Yeah.
Like the vape, you can vape everywhere, nonstop, all the time.
Yeah. Don't have enough medical data, but if it's not likely not good for your health, it probably is not good for your health. So just... Yeah. So I think cancer, that's one. So prevention is one.
Mm-hmm.
Detection is another one. So we look at cancer in two ways. Prevention, detection. So prevention, lifestyle factors. Don't smoke, sleep well, eat well, right? Eat less sugary foods. This is generally decreases your risk of cancer as a whole. On the detection side, there are cancer markers, tumor markers that debatable in terms of false positives and false negatives, but it's a nice precursor to what we call something we're very excited about is liquid biopsy. You're familiar with liquid biopsy?
No.
So liquid biopsy is this new technology that allows you, it's a new kind of blood test that looks into your blood to look for fragments of a shedding of DNAs of cancer cells in your blood. So if it's very early stage zero cancer, the tumor would be somewhere. And then it will start to shed. So from the DNA that is shedding, you're able to tell what cancer that is. Yeah. So it's very new, very expensive, but we are starting to offer it also in Mito Health starting Q4 this year. Yeah.
How early should people start to think about those things?
Yeah.
When should I start thinking, if let's say I'm 20 or 25, a woman or a man listening to this, when should I start thinking about stressing out about that? Oh man, I should get a test every year or every 6 months or whatever. Like how do I start my kind of health journey?
Yeah. When we look at our clients, what we do is we send them for a base panel. So we look at 63 different things in your blood. So 63 biomarkers and it covers the 4 diseases we talked about. But most importantly, for any young person, you reference the range is like 20s, right? The cardiovascular problems and the metabolic problems are the big ones that they should be looking out for because this can happen just purely based on bad diet. So if you're obese, you hardly move, you smoke, highly likely your arteries are lined with cholesterol, your cholesterol particles are a lot bigger, and we can actually look for those in your blood. Things like cancer, is a lot of it is also due to bad luck. So it could, some small part of it is due to genetics, but a large chunk is also due to luck. And those things can be detected later on in life.
Luck or lifestyle or both?
A lot of luck, actually. So you might have heard of people who have smoked their entire life.
No problem. People did a lot of sport.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's the excuse that a lot of people use to eat like shit and to not do any sport.
On a baseline, it's better to not do those things. But it's also based on research shown that a lot of it's really also due to luck. So on a baseline, just don't do many of those things because it just increases your risks, right? But if you do those things and then you're also unlucky, then it's going to be even worse for you. So you're better off if like you don't do those things and you are unlucky, and then you can detect it and then you can treat it, you can remove it, and then you get a better life expectancy. Yeah. That's how we think about the different horsemen. Yeah. So young people look out for cardiovascular problems, and we actually see it quite a lot. We just take care of your heart and your arteries and your blood vessels. Yeah.
So if I'm someone in my early 30s and I want to start to get to the next level in terms of health, what do you recommend me? Key pillars.
So the first one that you should do is to set a baseline. So what does that mean is that go for a checkup, understand your values and set targets, right? So you want to set targets to in terms of reducing certain values by certain degrees, and work with your medical professional. We can be your medical professional if you don't have one. So that's number one, setting baseline, going for a checkup, and then building a strategy. What fits into your life? What do you enjoy doing? So a lot of people, like, you shouldn't force yourself to do strength training if you're not someone who enjoys strength training, but do a similar activity. So some of them, we have clients who don't like to do PT, personal training. So then they end up going for group strength classes, like I think BFT, F45. So it's circuits, but there's elements of lifting weights at different parts of the circuit. So yeah, I think to find activities that fit into your life and not to force fit the recommendations into your life. Nutrition, the same thing. Look for replacements. A lot of the low-hanging fruits are replacements, yeah.
How important is strength training for good health?
It's very important.
For both men and women?
Yes, more important for women, actually, because of the risks of, postmenopausal for women, the brittle bone disease, like osteoporosis, is very real, post 50 years old. So someone like my mom, she's 58 now. We are sending her to a DEXA scan. So DEXA scan is like a gold standard for body composition in terms of fat, muscle, and bone density. So strength training basically helps build better bones, better skeletal muscle mass, and also stronger and also more muscle reserves. So that allows most people as they age beyond the age of 30 for everyone, male and female. You tend to lose muscle mass every single year. So it's research back that if you don't do anything, don't do strength training, don't eat enough protein, you are generally going to lose muscle mass every single year. Yeah.
Last one.
Yeah.
Regarding enough protein.
Yeah.
Is it possible to have enough protein by being a vegan?
So the problem is actually the concept of the bioavailability of like the protein. So generally speaking, based on what we know and the research that we've read, plant-based protein, like, you would need a lot more plant protein to actually compensate for the amount that you would get in traditional meat-based protein. So
you need to stuff yourself
more. Yeah.
A lot to be able to match the amount of protein,
absorption,
right?
and availability of the plant-based protein. Yeah, so it's not impossible. I mean, if you look at there was a Netflix documentary, I think it was
about the athletes, right?
Athletes, yeah. So it is possible, but I think it's consuming more based on, again, the research that we've read. Clients ask that question quite a bit as well. Because do you take whey? Do you take pea protein? Soy protein.
We talk about the protein, but now, can people get all the necessary nutrients on a vegan diet?
Well, I don't know enough on the full diet point of view, because there's like so many different replacements, right? I think there's like soy, there's plant-based. Yeah. So I don't know enough about the complete diet, but specifically like protein, that's the big question we always get. Yeah.
Amazing. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. Kenneth. Thanks for having me, and I enjoyed the conversation.
That was awesome. Where can people connect with you?
You can find me on LinkedIn or Instagram. LinkedIn is health-related stuff. We talk about what we're doing as a company, what are the latest science that we are actually injecting into our diagnostics, into our AI models. That's LinkedIn. Instagram is like I talk about my family, trying to grow a young one, an NFT, a young newborn, right? How do we build logic into his thinking and grow him as a person? Yeah.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Yeah.